I wouldn't be telling you about this, but I'm really your friend. Besides, I think this guy is probably, I don't know whether he's crazy or a provocateur, but that's where it usually comes up. Okay, interpersonal stuff having to do with romantic interests or actual relationships of people within the organization, one to the other, and playing one of those particular elements off against another to set up a negative dynamic. That's a good one. It's used a lot. By the way, did you know you who I just jacketed as being hitting on his wife, and I'll come around to you in just a moment, okay? Did you know that he was out selling the party newspaper today and probably sold 400 copies of the fake because it was a really good day, and I saw somebody give him a $50 donation, and he came back and he turned in 25 bucks. Misappropriation of organizational funds. And yeah, by the way, you know, but your husband there, not only is he misappropriating funds, but he's hitting on her. Okay, so now I got this whole big triangulated, two-part, two-level kind of distrust and insecurity thing, which ultimately is going to end up here. One of the people involved in this is probably a police agent. This is a technique known as bad jackney. In prison, it's called snitch jackney. It comes out of prison. Prison authorities pioneered this stuff, okay? Somebody is particularly resistant. They want to take down the prison. What they do is circulate the rumor among other inmates who are engaged in whatever they're engaged in. This particular guy is ratting them out to the prison administration to watch what happens to him. Well, at the very least, he's going to have no friends to talk to anymore. But if you think it's going to end there, you're completely detached from the reality of a prison environment. Same thing works when the stakes go up in a political organization. When the pressure comes down, they know they've been infiltrated, and the jeopardy is high because people are getting railroaded into prison for nothing. They're getting neutralized by killing or other forms of violence. Getting labeled with a snitch jacket is a real good way to get dead, or a very good way to get yourself beaten to a pulp, or at the very, very least, completely expelled from the organization. And who is it that gets bad jacketed? The more effective, the better. They take the bona fide activists within the organization and they'll triangulate them if need be to create the disimpression, or even plant evidence, as it did with Stokely Carmichael. The FBI had this animus thing going with the Central Intelligence Agency for about 20 years. Well, they didn't want to take the onus of having had any relationship with Carmichael at all, so they had one of their snitches plant a goldenrod copy of a false informant report to see of a car that he was riding in, so the guy who was driving the car would find it after he left. Yeah, to create the impression that there was actually physical evidence indicating the fact that Stokely Carmichael was a CIA agent who was bent upon destroying the Black Liberation Movement, in which he was a key leader. And you'll still hear people talk about that. Once planted, once these rumors are out there, once there's appearances of substantiation, once somebody who's supposedly credible accuses somebody else of being an agent. Well, two things happen. Some people never get the word that it was wrong. I guess there's three things. Some people get the word that it was wrong, but they just don't care anymore, and so they forget, or they're sloppy, and they repeat it anyway. And then you got a third cast of characters who they may know it's wrong, but it suits their interests because they're in a political disagreement of the sort that has to do with whether the dancing dialectic is a pure enough form to allow for social revolutions by the waiting of objective condition are now correct for the revolution to occur. And so even false information is useful to them to discredit their opposition, and they'll perpetuate the stuff. You don't have to be a cop to do a cop's work, in other words. Okay? They play upon our own weaknesses and animus and frailties in order to have us self-destruct. This is a good way to do it. But sometimes that kind of disinformation internal to the organization coupled to that kind of information they're putting out external to the organization is insufficient in and of themselves to take down the organization. Well then, but usually not before, they escalate. If you survive all that turmoil, and you're actually cohesive, and you're actually able to engage, and you actually are able to attract additional recruits, and so forth, well then, try this. Philadelphia 1967 Revolutionary Action Movement had done that. Very disciplined organization, had a very clear vision of what it wanted to do. You agree with it or you don't, but it's not for lack of clarity on their part. They knew what they were about. Arrest her. She's a key cadre. Okay, take her to jail. Let her make bail. as she comes out, arrest her again. Her pants were too short. Above her shoes, take her in for violation of fashion police protocols. Make her make bail. As she comes out, arrest her again. Take her back in. Spitting on the sidewalk this time. As she comes out, arrest her again. And there's another key cadre, do the same thing. There's another, do the same thing. There's another, do the same thing. Okay, there's several things going to happen with this is referred to as pretext arrest. There's no intent to obtain a conviction, although sometimes that happens, so much the better, but the point is to make the arrest. And then make another arrest, and then make another arrest, and arrest as fast and furiously as you can on any particular charge you can conjure up, even if it's bogus as a $3 bill, because you're going to raise the capacity or the frustration level beyond the capacity of the individual to endure it, number one. In this Philadelphia operation I'm talking about, they're talking about a guy who was a strong organizer by the end of the summer, was last time they came into his apartment, just looked at him and said, oh, God damn, hit the floor and was crying. He just sort of like went to pieces and gets taken again. Okay? Obviously, organizers who are sitting in jail and bailing themselves out and getting arrested and going back in aren't doing much organizing either. Okay? But the process of making bail, I mean, I don't know how many rich organizers you're aware of, but I've been at it a while, and I haven't met many. I have met a couple. Okay? And a couple of them have bailed me out from time to time because I ran out of money. And that's the key. There's only a certain number of times that your average street organizer, radical, whatever, is going to be able to bail themselves out of the jail before they run out of money. Now they're going to be sitting there. And even if they got the money to keep meeting the bail, I mean, they got these charges pending. Whether or not you as the police agency figure to be able to make these charges stick, to mount a successful prosecution, get a conviction, even if you don't believe you can, they don't know that. So they're going to have to retain an attorney or attorneys, depending on the nature of the charges. And if you multiply that by five or six targeted key activists within the organization, what you're going to be able to do is not only bankrupt in terms of its personnel available and energy to engage in organizing, but you're going to more literally bankrupt it. It's going to go right off the end of its financial capacity to mount a defense. Now you might just get lucky and actually make some of these bogus charges stick on somebody, because that's the next level. If pretext arrests aren't working, if they manage to demonstrate what you're doing there, nullify that procedure, then you mount actual frame-up kinds of cases on serious charges where you manufacture the evidence and you suppress the exculpatory evidence and you attempt to obtain conviction for, oh, I don't know, murder in the first degree, child molestation, smoking in a public place. Yeah, it doesn't matter. Obtain a conviction. The longer, the better. Usually the more serious charges are aimed at the more, what they call key activists. They actually had a key agitators index, they called it, and they had a key agitators photo album, okay, with pictures, because not all the agents knew all of the activists they were supposed to be paying attention to. So you could go in and you could thumb through this thing and you could see what their face looked like, who they were, and why they were important. In the mind of the Bureau, who it was you were supposed to be taking out. Okay? Beyond that, you have the creation of, and they picked this one up from a couple of British counterinsurgency theorists named Robin Evely and Frank Kitson, who worked in Kenya and Northern Ireland. Creation of something called a pseudo-gang. All right? Why they call it a pseudo-gang, I don't know. Maybe because pseudo-organization is too cumbersome to come off the term. Maybe it had to do with the sort of disdain which they viewed their political opposition. Whatever they call a pseudo-gang, it's where you go, and if you can't co-opt an organization into doing your bidding, you create one of your own. We've got several examples of that out there. In my own framework of experience, we had Terry and Jill Schaefer come cruising into Wounded Knee announcing that they were the representatives of the Red Star Collective. Somebody out there want to volunteer to give us all the history of the Red Star Collective and its valiant efforts in behalf of, I don't know, take your pick, the homeless, sweatshop workers, the environment, animal rights? No. Red Star Collective never existed other than in a briefing sheet to the FBI telling these people what it was they were supposed to say when they got there. They created their whole organization. They wrought havoc in terms of relations between American Indian Movement and some left organizations for a while, coming down with a dancing dialectic sort of rap that I just delivered a while ago, and they were pretty good at it, and we weren't the only organization that they had approached and disrupted in this capacity. They'd done it with the Vietnam Veterans Against the War as well. Okay, the thing with pseudo-gay, either you want to co-opt an existing organization or create one of your own to play it off against a bona fide organization to create an interorganizational dispute, particularly one that you think you can convert into a context of violence because that's your next level. You haven't been able to take these people out with pretext, arrest, discrediting, internal disruption, any of the rest of this stuff. Now, this is one of the levels of surrogates they use to use actual political activists, foment disagreement, exacerbate tensions, instigate misunderstandings and so forth in order to try to get people ultimately into what they call a shooting war. That's how John Huggins and Bunchy Carter ended up being dead in UCLA. Okay? And this takes us to a name that's familiar because this is one of the people who was severed from the case and shouldn't be, a guy by the name of Richard Wallace Held. Okay? Now, this is a real interesting construct. Before I go to LA, I'm going to have to say a little bit about Richard Held. Well, actually, he's not schizophrenic, but that has to be a plural. A plural, yeah. Can I get some water? My tongue's starting to stick to my roof of my mouth here. Anybody getting water over here?
There you go.
Thank The reason Richard Held is a plural, Richard Hells, is because it's a father and son team. Richard G. Held, the old man, interesting actor. He's one of the architects of COINTELPRO. After they hit Mark and Fred, Marlon Johnson, who was a SAC Chicago, took a sudden retirement when it began to come out what was happening. They brought a guy in from Washington, D.C., internal security section of the FBI. He was ahead of the internal security section. They brought him in Chicago to take over his SAC, but left him in charge of internal security as well. That had never happened in the history of the Bureau, where somebody was running one of the offices, one of the entire branches of the FBI headquarters, and serving a SAC with a major field office, but he had been brought in with expertise to cover up what it was that had happened there. When Wounded Knee happened, they detached him from his position in Chicago and sent him as an FBI troubleshooter to Wounded Knee to devise basically an action plan for what to do with AIM in the aftermath of Wounded Knee. After the firefight, which leads to Peltier being in prison, happens in Oglala in 1975, they brought him back from Chicago and put him in charge of what was called the Res MERS investigation, which was basically a low-intensity or counterinsurgency war that was mounted. They actually brought in FBI in a military capacity with armored personnel carriers and all that. He presided over it, and there's a counterintelligence operation that's going on underneath the counterinsurgency operation that is the most overt. Okay, having done all this, he was already retirement age. They extended his retirement until he was 73 years old, promoted him ultimately on the basis of these services rendered to be an associate director of the FBI. That's the father. The son is Richard W. Okay? He's already conversant with his stuff. It's in the family. His first assignment, becoming a young FBI agent, is to get into Los Angeles, all right, on the COINTELPRO section, Racial Matters desk, all right? Now, one little overlap there is when Daddy came to Pine Ridge to run a Res MERS thing, he asked his boy to be detached from L.A. to come out to San Francisco. Well, Richard Wallace Held was the guy who in this sort of junior capacity, his introductory capacity on the COINTELPRO, the Panther desk, basically, in L.A. He's smart, in a weird kind of way. He says, you know, a real good way to mess these guys up is you got this black nationalist organization called United Slaves down there run by Ron Karinga. And the Panthers were kind of ascendant. I mean, their star is rising right now. They're a revolutionary nationalist organization. These two outfits don't see eye to eye, and there's an ego problem. I mean, Karinga figures he's top of the heap. So how about this? Emory Douglas, who's the cartoonist for the Black Panther newspaper, has a very distinctive graphic style. How about we get somebody down in our propaganda shop to duplicate that style and make up a bunch of cartoons that are just derogatory as hell in their depiction of Ron Karinga? and we send some people out impersonating Panthers on the street corner handing these things out, defaming us in the name of the Panthers. And by the way, they got graphics artists in the United Slaves Organization as well. How about we get the same guy who's duplicating Emory Douglas' stuff to do a few cartoons that look like stuff that's coming out of us, okay, and have them circulated in the street corners defaming the Panthers at the same time. Look, these guys are, this is a direct quote from the document, these guys are violence prone. Operation Hoodwink starts raising its stench in the midst of this. We figure that they'll probably neutralize one another. Well, that was Karinga's guys and an FBI guy, at least one, maybe three, that went into Campbell Hall at UCLA, shot John and Bunch. That was a response to the cartoons. Or at least Held thought it was, because any internal memoranda reporting on the incident at Campbell Hall, he says it was indication of the success of the COINTELPRO operation and therefore recommends it will be continued. And that's approved at headquarters, and they put out a whole new batch of cartoons, which leads about 4 months later to the death of Sylvester Bell, a Black Panther organizer selling a party newspaper on a corner in San Diego, shot to death by two members of the United Slaves Organization, and Hill took credit for that one too and recommended that a new batch of cartoons be put out. The last score I got on is the FBI's official score. Okay, this is all on the West Coast, but there's also United Slaves and Black Panther activity in Newark because of Mary Baraka had started with the United Slaves there. Okay, they're putting out a scorecard. It says, and I quote, us 6, Panthers 0. So I don't know who the last two of the Panthers that were attributed, the Panther fatalities attributed to this particular operation were. I haven't been able to put names to it, but the FBI was counting 6 Panther fatalities as a score of this, and we're trying to bait the Panthers into responding in kind to take out Baraka's cadres in Newark, New Jersey. That's the nature of the operation here. That's the use of the surrogates, but it's also the founding claim to fame of Richard Wallace Held, who was a special agent in charge of the San Francisco office under which the counterterrorism—terrorist would be a more appropriate term—personnel who bombed Judy Berry or orchestrated the bombing of Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney worked. Okay, but it's not his only claim to fame in L.A. Beyond that, he was the prime mover in the framing of Geronimo Pratt that I just mentioned. He was detached on a base, so he's also involved with the secret army organization activity down there, and on the basis of his successes in these fields was taken to work under his daddy to set up the context in which you have the framing of Leonard Peltier. And all of that had worked out so well that about the time his dad gets promoted to be FBI associate director, he gets to be named SAC San Juan, Puerto Rico, at a very young age. I mean, he is a rising star in the FBI. In his capacity as SAC San Juan, he organizes, orchestrates, coordinates an island-wide raid to basically roll up the entirety of the independence movement in 1985. I mean, 300 agents island-wide, they're hitting doors, kicking things in. Okay, they're using the helicopters, they got APCs they borrowed from the Army in case they need them, which there they didn't, and he had learned that particular technique working under his father on Pine Ridge in 1975, because that's exactly what they did there. But it was such a sensational thing that ultimately he gets rewarded again, way, about 10 years before you would expect in the Bureau's normal career progressions to achieve such an exalted position, named to be SAC San Francisco, which is one of the top field offices in the country. Now, he's in his early 40s at this point. This guy's been slated to be an associate assistant, at least a deputy director of the FBI, or maybe the director itself. Comes the Cherney Berry suit. He suddenly takes an early retirement from this star-studded trajectory that he's on. Now, how many of you in here have a Visa card? Come on, fess up, there's more than that. Okay, that's better. Yeah, well, you'll rest real well tonight. You'll sleep secure knowing that in charge of the security of your Visa card is Richard Wallace Held. Yeah, you now head of security for the Visa Corporation. Well, that's the general drift of it. The only thing that I would say to tie it now, we can take it in more detail in the Q&A, but I've already talked longer than I meant to, but I wanted to get this sort of laid out here in a shape. They don't use that cryptonym anymore. COINTELPRO's back. It never really went away. It's here in a much more refined form, okay, because they've got the technological capacity to do these things, and they have much more experience in these techniques than they had during the days of COINTELPRO proper. But they don't call it COINTELPRO anymore. They don't need to. They don't need a cryptonym at all. Because what the Omnibus Anti-Terrorism Act in 96 primarily did, and what the Homeland Security Act in particular finished doing in its recent iteration, is take everything that was illegal about COINTELPRO activities during the 1950s, 60s, and 70s and legalize it. So now they're just right out front and in your face, but they tell you they're combating terrorism. Well, the fact of the matter is, when you look at the Berry example, when you look at the Hampton-Clark example, when you look at Huggins and Carter, when you look at Pedro Bissonnette, when you look at all the rest of what I'm talking about, you need to understand that they are, in fact, the terrorists. And what is it that is going to be done to protect us from the terrorism embodied in them?
Right on.
Well, I want to talk about something that's just come up called the Praetor Guidelines and such as well, but I'm just going to hold that because I need another slug of water and I'm sweating, my mouth's getting dry, and I think I probably talked too long. I'm out of time and I'm out of words, so now we can interact. Thank you very much for listening.
The charges that led to Marilyn Buck actually being incarcerated. I heard there was like they tried to pin like the release of Assata Shakur on her, plus some other things, but it was kind of unclear to me. So,
okay, the question that was asked was the charges that relate to the incarceration of Marilyn Buck. Are y'all familiar with Marilyn Buck?
No.
Y'all familiar with the Black Liberation Army?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, generally speaking, well, this is not exactly accurate, but that will work as well as anything for a soundbite. Marilyn Buck was the only actual white member of the Black Liberation Army, okay, which says a whole lot about her consciousness, her commitment, and the nature, the level of her engagement, okay? And there's not a simple and easy answer to the charges related to Marilyn Buck and why she's in prison, because there's several trials and several layers of charges. The key one, however, had to do with expropriation of money from federal banking institutions, okay, for purposes of funding guerrilla activity in the United States, which was framed in the prosecution under the RICO Act. You understand what that is? Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organization Act, okay? It's something that Bob Blakey and other brain children of the anti-mafia 1960s came up with to fight organized crime. That's what it's supposedly, that's what Congress at least thought it was passing the thing to do. Of course, it wasn't applied to organized crime in the mafia sense for about 20 years after it was passed, but it was applied against Marilyn Buck, Mutulu Shakur, the Ohio Seven, the Resistance Conspiracy, you name it. Okay, understanding that in order to operate in a clandestine fashion, any movement requires funding. You're not likely to be able to go down and panhandle it on Haight Street, so probably in the amounts you need it, you need to get it from where it is, and where it is going to be in banks and armored cars, okay? Well, that's not exactly legal under the statutory code of the United States. Therefore, as an organization, you're engaged in criminal activity, okay? Organized engagement criminal activity is considered to be under that law racketeering, and so they're taking anti-racketeer laws and applying to political targets for purposes of obtaining what I think she's serving 70 years. So is Mutulu Shakur. You understand? It's a very effective tool. They take lots of these things that are supposedly designed to fight crime. Organized criminal activity of various sorts. I mean, they've always got a war on crime, a war on drugs, or both going on at the same time. Usually that's in the face of declining crime stats. I mean, the first one back in the 30s, which was about kidnapping, Okay, that one was mounted after kidnapping and gone into decline for four straight years. That's a consistent pattern. Catches people's attention, it's already over, and then they affect some draconian statute, self-authorization to vamp on your rights as a result. In this particular case, they use anti-drug statutes quite a lot. Yeah?
George Bush appointed Robert Mueller to the head, the director of the FBI. He's coming to town on April 19th, as we all heard earlier. It's going to be a rally. Can you talk a little bit about who Robert Mueller is?
Not a lot. These guys have lost their luster and personality. As far as I can tell, Mueller is just basic bureaucrat. If he has any particular background in these areas or any other area of interest to me, I'm unaware of it. And I think they like it that way. They'd rather have a plain vanilla director. Okay? Louis Free was supposed to be, but he was too ideological and kept getting his own way in public, you know? Take this guy who's about to be run out and facing capital murder charges over Ruby Ridge and promoting second days there to be an assistant director was not the brightest move in the world. Okay, and that's how he started. So they want somebody who's a little more accomplished than that and way below the radar.
I know he was involved in the money laundering investigation. That's one thing I do know about him, which ties into Enron and a lot of what we know about where drugs come from.
Could be. You know, could very well be. I wouldn't argue on that. I just don't know them having a particular political jacket in terms of repression. They've all got a political jacket in terms of perpetuating status quo. Okay, there's going to be some kind of service rendered there. They otherwise would not have come up on this sort of back channel radar screen that propels them into the office. They just want them to be below the radar screen for public consciousness, okay? But he's done good work in their view to get in that position, which means he's done bad work in our view, and yeah, there it is. Okay, we got here, here, and here.
Could you talk about how you do your research and how you get hold of information?
Well, there's lots of different ways. The question is, how do I do the research? How do I get a hold of information? Depends on the information, for starters. Okay, the FBI stuff. Well, I don't know how many of you know it, but you know there used to be this thing called Freedom of Information Act, which was really, really imperfect. Okay. But nonetheless, had certain effect. As a result of the Freedom of Information Act, well, the process works like this. People were entitled, in the first instance, to request their own FBI file. Right? There's a whole intricate little process you have to go through to get. The first thing they'll do is tell you they can't give it to you. The second thing, they're going to ask you to complete your file for them. Okay, the third thing is they start to actually divulge. So you've got these three levels of appeal you have to go through. And then you get this redacted material, except for what is withheld for reasons of national security or because of about three or four other exemptions. National security is always the one that interested me. You know, they open a file in some sixth grade student's biology department in New Jersey, and parents sue, and there's a court-ordered disclosure of the file, and there's every bit of 48 pages in it, 30 of them are classified withheld for national security reasons. But in any event, the rule was this. Any page that they divulged on FOIA went to public domain and is therefore recoverable by anybody else. And on that basis, aside from some broader suit bases, they established what they call the FBI reading room, to which you have to demonstrate that you have a press or academic credential or other discernible interest of a research variety. You then have to make an appointment. You can go in. They don't have ashtrays or trying to drive you back out, okay? All right, you can do a manual search of the indices of everything that's been released by name or by subject, by organization, or whatever. They've got something upwards of 3 million pages in this domain. About a third of that's readily available and racks in the room. Okay, you can't take the paper with you. You sit there, they give you paper clips, okay, and a little pad of 3x5 paper and a pencil. You can't take your own stuff in there either. Okay, so you have this pencil, you have this pad, you have these paper clips. Every time you hit a document you want, you're supposed to put a paper clip on it. All right? A little cumbersome. And you can make notes to yourself in their provided pad with their provided pencil. It's just kind of like being in prison. Yeah.
And you really start to feel that way. There's no windows, you know, it's white light, it's concrete blocks, it's this formica top, I mean, a very sterile environment, and you're sitting there going through these mountains of paper. Everyone you paperclip, they will Xerox for you after the fact. It will then come to you in the mail along, well, actually, usually they get you get the bill first. And when you pay the bill, you then get the information in a big envelope from them, okay, at the rate, what is it now, 50 cents a page? So you get like the Rosenberg file, which is 110,000 pages, do the arithmetic, okay? But it's accessible. Another way that I got to a lot of it was Jonathan Lubell, who did the Freedom of Information Act suit on behalf of Geronimo Pratt, had 173,000 pages of paper. It's one guy, 173,000 pages. If Dennis Cunningham was here, I could check, but I recall that at People's Law Office in Chicago, where he worked before he came out here, that's where the Hampton-Clark suit was held. There were another 120 or 30,000 pages there, plus a whole lot of photo material and so forth. That comes with it if you can pay for it, but this is a court-ordered disclosure. Well, and that gives me 250,000 pages of documents to work with as a base. We've got Peltier's disclosure files. We've got other disclosure files. John Trudell's got 17,000 pages on himself personally. On and on and on. Okay? Now, a lot of these are duplicate, but you'll notice a real interesting thing in the deletion patterns of the FBI. See, they don't just do a redaction on documents and then release them in that form every time. They take the original and they go over it for redaction purposes. Depending on who's requesting, they redact different things. So if you get 7 or 8 different iterations of the same document released to different organizations, different people, for different reasons, okay, compare them side by side, you can often come up with almost a complete document. Yeah. So that's one of the methods. And I assume that's the direction your question was going, basically to the official paper. Well, it's official and it's classified, but it gets declassified these ways. Okay, back here.
You remind me so much about Chet Barker and friend of mine, John Stockwell, who wrote.
How's John doing these days? We got trapped in Dulles Airport for about 8 hours in a blizzard once, he and I. So, how's he doing? This was a really insane conversation. Trust me on that.
I wanted to ask you a question about causality about 9/11. An awful lot of speculation based on what people, a lot of information that came out about how much FBI and the CIA knew and how much information they exchanged with foreign intelligence sources with Mossad, French intelligence, and Egyptian intelligence warning about this potential for this 9/11 event. There seems to be so much warning. And do you think it was just a tremendous national security breakdown, or do you think that there was some hope that maybe something would happen, but not as big as we thought it would happen? They didn't think it would be as bad as it was. Do you think some quid pro quo or some causality, or was it just really this massive security breakdown?
You know, I cannot rule out the possibility that there's this Illuminati-type conspiracy of intelligence agencies on the planet, and that the Queen of England's actually the world's primary drug importation coordinator and all the rest of that. And I'm deliberately ridiculing this because every time something happens or comes up, this grand conspiracy theory to make it other than what it was, which was in all probability absolute ineffectuality in terms of being able to deal with what it was, they purportedly doing all these things to deal with. Okay? You think this kind of security apparatus that they're building works? Ask the Israelis. It never has yet, and they've got much shorter borders to try to defend and a whole lot more experience in certain ways in continuous combat to try to do it. It leaks like a sieve. This has to do with controlling the body politic inside the United States for purposes of internal stability. That's all. if somebody wants to fly an aircraft into the next large building, like that ungodly triangular thing you have in San Francisco, there's nothing in the world going to prevent it. Yeah? As to the way they use it, that's entirely predictable. Look, I've talked about Peltier before, didn't talk about that aspect of things tonight. I do not believe, although it's been argued in that connection too, that the FBI deliberately set their two guys up to get killed because then they could use it as a pretext to do blah, blah. They didn't set their own two guys up to get killed. They screwed up the operation, the two guys got killed, and since they were dead, they used it to their advantage. Since they flew planes into buildings, that was not part of some conspiratorial plan, but since it happened, best to take this incredible faux pas and turn it into something to their advantage. Any good politician or bureaucrat or intelligence agent would do that. Okay? I guess the last point I'd like to make on that is really just it's a no-brainer, self-evident, probably everybody already here already says it, already sees it, but I want to say it anyway. If you're actually concerned with people doing things like that because they aren't much fun to experience and they probably could qualify right well with any kind of definition of terrorism that you want to frame because they're intended to inflict terror. The question is whether it's right or wrong that terror should be inflicted. If you actually want to prevent another 911, here's how you do it. Stop killing their babies.
Right.
That's it. Simple as that. Yeah, I'm going to go a little while longer here, so I'm going to go there, I'm going to come here, and...
So this is Daryl.
Yeah, I know, and I'm just saying hi. I didn't realize that.
Nobody recognizes
me. I'm going back there because that guy's been waiting. There is also some... I'm going there, I'm coming over here. Search and Destroy?
Yeah.
Search and Destroy is a good book insofar it was the very first thing written. It's relatively comprehensive. It was early on, not to let the thing die out of public consciousness. He's pointing to the problems. It's a very imperfect book, but what can you expect when the people who are the perpetrators are in charge of the evidence and they're withholding it? Okay? That was basically the situation. So given what was available to work with, it was a very good job. What do I think of Ramsey Clark? Is that part of your question?
Yeah.
I don't know the guy personally. Oh, I do know that he has made a career of doing exactly what I'm talking about.
He wrote Fire This Time.
He's written a bunch of books, and he is about the only person that I know of who actually consistently tried to get a 500,000 dead Iraqi children in front of the body politic of the United States and saying this is more important than a lot of the things that are being paid attention to. Okay? And for that, I think he's got all kinds of respect. Okay?
This is just some other incidents that you may wish to integrate, and I think sometimes the left overlooks some of them. The Greensboro assassination
sure.
was an FBI BATF operation, the same ones that hit Waco. It was the same combination. The MOVE assassinations and bombing of the building, and Mumia's case is a COINTELOPERO operation. And I think we should trace the beginning of the FBI even before they were called the FBI. Their first frame up, as far as I know, was Sacco and Vanzetti. And a Supreme Court Justice, Felix Frankfurter, wrote the definitive first book exposing the case. It certainly wasn't everything that the defense committee wrote. And so gives a broader picture, and I think you might want to integrate some of it.
Well, if you're going to go back to before the Bureau was the Bureau, you know, you want to go back before the Bureau of Investigation as well. You can take it back to the Reno Gang in Indiana, the Pinkertons, because the precursor to the FBI is the Pinkerton Detective Agency. In fact, the first roster of personnel in the Bureau of Investigation were all Pinkertons. So, yeah, you can take it all the way back. Actually, I'm going to hold that. There's another, with Waco in particular, really critical ingredient. It wasn't just BATF and FBI, okay? But we got hands that are kind of like mushrooms that are going up here. So just somebody, if I start to walk out of the room, without having said anything about Praetor, somebody screamed Praetor at me, and I'll come back to it, because I really need to say something about that before I get out of here. But I also want to see about questions that get addressed here. Yeah, go right there.
I just need to say I misspoke when I spoke earlier, and we're the second case, and Fred Hansen was the first case. Their jury hung, but they did go in front of the jury and have a trial. I've been agonizing this whole time, and I have to say that.
I wasn't going to mention that. I just stuck with the criminal one.
You're very
grateful.
What are you about letters?
Okay, we will. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to put a somewhat additional point. In the
okay.
First place, one way of getting files is the way they did it in Medea, Pennsylvania. The other was the National Lawyers Guild sued for them. And we got the files, hundreds of thousands of pages. And I think it's possible to use the legal system. And I want it sometimes in some ways, and I think it's worth saying. I also say I flatly disagree that 50% of members of the Communist Party in 1960 were agents. We can fight about that another time.
Okay.
But I just want to say one affirmative thing that people have a right to know, and it hasn't been in the press. The United Nations adopted two treaties against terrorism, one against terrorist bombing and one against terrorist financing. And believe it or not, and it hasn't been in the press, on December 5th, 2001, the U.S. Senate ratified both of those treaties. And both of those treaties specifically guarantee that anybody charged under terrorist bombing or terrorist financing has due process rights. And the U.S. President signed them and the Senate ratified them. And last Monday, the anti-terrorist bombing treaty became effective because enough countries had ratified it all over the world. In addition to which, the House of Representatives on December 15th passed a law called the Anti-Terrorist Bombing and Financing Implementation Act, so that if the Senate then passed that same law, it would be a criminal law within the United States, and it contains these protections. And I think it's worthwhile for those of us who do not want to have to use terrorist tactics ourselves or guns to use the law that exists and to encourage the Senate to pass the Anti-Terrorist Bombing and Financing Implementation Act and to insist that every person who's arrested, you were saying at the beginning of your speech that people from somewhere else don't have due process rights. That's not under the U.S. Constitution. So I think we have to make clear that the U.S. President, Senate, and House have now committed this government to give due process rights to anybody charged. They may not do it, but they have committed themselves.
Okay.
And I used to teach here, so.
Good for you. But one point of clarification, I think, that goes to making what you were saying resonate a little better. You got a treaty signed, and then you got a dual caption statute, which would be the Implementation Act for both. You're not talking about three different laws. You're talking about two elements of international law being implemented under a single statute in the United States, correct?
But done by the House and the Senate, so the President can't...
Yeah, the Senate ratifies, both houses got to pass an implementation statute. But you're talking about one law, actually, that people need to be paying attention to in terms of U.S. judicial application, correct?
Well, it's two treaties.
You don't apply a treaty in a U.S. court. You apply a statute. We understand.
Absolutely not. Not even one of them.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, well, non-U.S. nationals fall under a doctrine you may recognize when it's called plenary power, which is the full and absolute authority of the federal government of the United States to exercise at its discretion whatever series of rights, protections, or lack of same it chooses with regard. And that is what the Constitution says, okay, because that whole doctrine is outside the Constitution, so there's no provision for those outside it at all. All right. He's been trying a while in here. And I also have heard that there was a much higher percentage than 50 by 1960. I do try to be polite, but I don't get that far sometimes. Okay, right there.
Feel free to defer this question from the immediate topics at hand, but if I can digress, you know, I was communicating, and he may be here tonight, I don't know. I was communicating with a guy who runs a progressive email list, and he was apologizing in one instance, if I'm correct, for something where he was accused of siding with, suicide bombers or something like that in Palestine. And he was apologizing, so I sent him an email saying, you know, so what if Zionists or pro-Israel lobby people are accusing you of being an Arab sympathizer or whatever, progressive side with the oppressed, period. So it seems like, you know, when you're talking about Palestine, everyone's got to, even progressives have got to start out saying, you know, I condemn suicide bombers, but... And so I'm wondering...
They condemn themselves, so...
I'm wondering what perspective you put this, seems like this knee-jerk reaction to start off, you know, as based about immediate circumstances with condemning suicide bombers, when one, I don't know why it's any more honorable to shoot civilians from an aircraft 5 miles away than to give your own life and the freedom and the struggle for the freedom of your own people.
Know that I can improve upon what you just said. I don't apologize for anybody's efforts to defend their people from what amounts to genocide. I don't condemn anybody, whether I agree with them or not, for choosing whatever motive attempting to defend themselves seems appropriate to them in the moment when they themselves are in danger, not me. I don't sit in the bleachers and make decisions for what's appropriate to other people who are in harm's way. And I don't really acknowledge the right of anyone else as a point of moral purity to do that either. If you want to interpose yourself physically, then do so. Otherwise, shut up, okay, about what they're doing and get busy doing something yourself that takes care of the problem so they don't have to make those kinds of choices. That's not all I can add, but I'm with you.
I'm informing all of you of something that's happening with our species and our evolution. Basically, we're an all-set linear savants. We're non-linear versions of what in the movie Rain Man, that the character Dustin Hoffman played. In Hindu culture, we're called sadhus, if you know about that. In American Indian culture, they're called contraries, or thunder dreamers, or and so we're the next step in evolution. So, like people like Lenny Bruce, Andy Kaufman, Mike Patton of Faith No More, Scott Bourne, used to skate for Consolidated Skateboards, Kurt Cobain, Aesop Rock, General Hypercleese of the Church of Subgenius, if you know who they are.
You're all guys.
Sung about her in one of his songs. Francis Farmer was also the reason why they tend to be more apparent is because, you know, gender bias and stuff. Bruce Lee was also this too. They push evolution, and so the thing is, like, in Taoist culture, they're known as Chenjens, and then also in Buddhist culture, they're known as Bodhisattvas. And the thing is, because they're so highly individualistic, if you are a herd person or you have that in you, you almost like unconsciously persecute them or you cause them to self-destruct. So they don't become serial killers, they become mass murderers. So something like in Columbine, that's why they went crazy and shot those kids up. Because and when you're an all-set non-linear savant,
yeah, it's
okay, well, being all set linear, here's the thing. Because you have such an immense awareness, everything becomes energy. So if you've ever seen the movie Akira...
I'm just going to ask you, with respect, is this going to tie to FBI and counterintelligence and such stuff at some point?
Exactly. There's a thing called HARP. It's called High Altitude Auroral Research Project. It attacks your non-linear mind. We are people who are, like, specifically geared towards nonlinear thinking. So when they hit you, it's a form of electronic surveillance, because everything's electrons, right? And it, they either beam it down, possibly through cell phones or the cell phone towers that they hide up in trees at night. And people, this is what's so funny, is it's people get like, what are you talking about? No, this is the cusp of our evolution. This goes through everything. And, like, you know, things like the Mobius strip and stuff like that. People, it's all over.
Yeah. It's got to be tied a little bit to what we're talking about. So, thank you.
It's good stuff, though.
Yeah, might be. Might be. That's why I said with respect.
Can you give an update on Larne's legal situation? It's my understanding that there's a filed lawsuit.
Lawsuit, as I understand it, is for the 6,000 pages that were withheld of the 18,000 pages that related directly to his case. The first 12,000, as some of you probably know, included information, had been withheld on discovery at trial, which directly contradicted or provided exculpatory interpretation to information that was presented in the circumstantial case at trial. The 6,000 pages, that's one third of the entire documentary mass withheld, or withheld on, again, those grounds that I mentioned earlier, national security. We basically have always been a little curious as to how national security interests could be involved in the functioning of a domestic police agency within what the United States claims is a domestic jurisdictional sphere, not involving the activities of a foreign power. That's what's being challenged. The expectation is that the 6,000 documents in question, if released, are going to contain considerably more information that directly contradicts that which was presented to Leonard at trial and provide the basis for another appeal against the conviction. Say what? Can't hear you.
How's his health?
I can't speak to Leonard's teeth. Okay. I have a friend that's driving out from Georgia in about 10 days, stopping to see him. I'll be sure and ask her about his teeth. I don't know. That's the bottom line. Health generally is deteriorating. Leonard's not getting any younger. He's been in prison a long time. He was actually told, well, whatever it was he was told in the specific terms, put him in position of packing his clothes to leave in January, just before Clinton went out of office. Okay? He had plans made of where he was going to be, when he was going to see his kid, and what he was going to do. So that is not exactly a real affirmative emotional thing. And without going off into too much holistic anything, emotions and physical health are kind of tied together. If you're feeling high morale, you're not as susceptible to maladies as you are if you're not. Well, his morale couldn't be a whole lot lower than it was after that January. His health conditions were already poor, so they've declined accordingly. Now, here's a hard reality, I think. Leonard Peltier is not going to live another 8 years in a prison. It's not because he's necessarily coming out, but it's not going to be wait for the good guys to come back in office. Bill Clinton, everybody said, was the good guy. Right? Bill Clinton and Al Gore were both the guys who said, when they were saying, don't forget about Leonard. He said, we won't forget about Leonard. Yeah. Well, that was 8 years of that. Now there's another, presumptively, 8 years of the bad guy. Well, the bad guy ain't any worse than the good guy. He ain't getting out on that basis. Raises the question, how is he getting out? And I leave that one hanging for all the imaginations in the room to engage themselves and come up with a vision greater than mine. And it needs to be greater than mine. I've been involved in that case in 20 years. He's still in a cell. So one of you can think of something better than what I thought of. Power to you. Bring it out. Let's do it. All right, but it's not going to come through the tender mercies of the federal executive. It's not going to come through the adherence to judicial propriety of the U.S. judicial system. Okay, it's not going to come through the law. It's going to have to come another way. And to argue it any other way is to argue on the basis of somebody else's life. So, I'm going to take about one, two more. We got one
back. Yeah, we have time for one more question. Fairly short.
Praetor. One question plus Praetor. Is that fair? All right, Praetor. That's it. Actually, that gets me off the hook because we had one question announcing three, four people sitting there with their hands up, all of whom have been in for a while. Praetor. I said that tied to Waco.
does tie to Waco in a concrete sense, but it ties to Waco in an informational sense, too. How many, anybody, heard of Praetor? I'll spell it, P-R-A-E-T-O-R.
I recognize the spelling. I recognize the spelling.
Yeah, place the Praetorian, obviously. But Praetor is not something you would normally take as a deduction from Praetorian and bandy about in conversation. It actually has a substance, sorry. Years and years and years after, at Waco, they said they basically didn't have any further documents and stuff. And this is the same scenario that applies in all of these other cases. Hampton Clark, for example, the FBI contended that it, for 5 years, that it had no paperwork. Zero. Not only in Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, but in the Black Panther Party in Illinois. They didn't have any paper. Okay? Church committee got their hands on some. Somebody on the staff leaked it to somebody on the staff of the People's Law Office. They took them into court, showed the judge. The judge says, wait a minute. And the next day, they brought in three hand carts with 110,000 pages on it. That was the first edition, okay? Waco worked the same way. They didn't have any tapes, video, or audio. They didn't have any photographic evidence. They didn't have any file paper in whole broad areas. They didn't have interagency files, so forth, so on. Something else again. Okay, I really don't have the time in this last question to go through the piece-by-piece process by which this got altered, but ultimately you not only got a lot of paper coming out of the ATF and the FBI, but ultimately out of the Defense Department as well. And the segue into the Defense Department had to do with who provided the helicopter gunships and the two modified tanks and all of the stuff that was in there. And this really came out on approvals on equipment lending, because certain types of equipment require very special conditions and high clearance to be borrowed by a civilian agency. M1A1 tanks, for example, okay? It's not like your average supply lieutenant can sign a chit and somebody drives away with a tank, all right? Those things were approved for use by the hostage rescue team of the FBI, which, anybody out here, I keep doing polls, but sometimes I miss things. Anybody out there ever heard of the hostage rescue team of the FBI rescuing a hostage? I mean, it's been around for about 20 years. You ever heard of a hostage situation they intervened in? No, neither have I. You could use it as a very elite sniper and special operations team, however. This is your National Mobile SWAT Force, okay? These guys are essentially a military unit. They're used as a fire brigade. Since 9-1-1, they've been doubled in size. There were 51 of them. Now there's 103 or something like that. So they're expanding. But the point that I'm trying to go to here, and actually it does relate to the AHRT, is that in the bureaucratic paperwork having to do with the approvals here, there was some reference made to Praetor guidelines, which, like COINTELPRO, nobody had ever heard of before. The relationality of the word was obvious, but no one had encountered it before. It seems there is a Praetor protocol. Okay, following on the Praetor protocol and from the equipment inventories to the training manifest, it turns out the HRT was trained for Waco by something called Delta Force. Anybody ever heard of Delta Force? It's not just Chuck Norris movie. Okay, within the so-called Green Berets special force structure of the United States Army, there is, like the HRT, an ultra-elite unit that's used essentially as a mobile assassination or special intervention squad. That's who trained the HRT with regard to Waco. And then it turns out, provided what they assure us were only technicians having to do with acoustics and maintenance. Acoustics. So they brought a rap band down to Waco to record an FBI's greatest hits album while they were engaged in the Secret Surprise Division? No. They have insertion teams to plant listening devices in other people's secure areas, okay? But the interesting thing that comes off Praetor and the provision of Delta Force personnel, not only to train FBI personnel for special operations in the connection with that siege, and then providing acoustic support and maintenance personnel, is that it was primarily for that purpose. Okay, primarily, they were doing special insertions of listening devices within the Branch Davidian compound during the context of the siege and maintaining that, but that was having been their primary function. What were their other functions? Those were unspecified. But ultimately, this occurs under the Praetor, Praetorian, guideline on a protocol which allows for a combination of the HRT and the Army's Delta Force to be deployed in times of specified civil emergency designated as such by the Chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff and the highest civilian authority. Okay? Essentially, that's to say, on a declaration in secret of the President, a secret military unit combined with a semi-secret FBI unit to be used for secret purposes unspecified against the public of the United States at any given time. All right? And that's not something that's fabricated or conjured up as being a potentiality coming at us. It's something that they already had formulated and in place by 1993. Nobody knew about it until 1999.
Is that Rex 84?
Actually, it ties to Rex 84, but actually that ties to Northern California. All right, the whole deal that we're talking about here was actually engineered in the first instance as a counterinsurgency scenario by a guy that some of you may recognize the name, Louis Giafrida. Louis Giafrida was a specialist, a counterinsurgency specialist working for a civil defense training institute, as they called it, that was commissioned by the state of California during the Reagan governorship. Okay, Giafrida was asked to come up with a couple of scenarios to integrate federal, state, local, military, and private civic organizational responses to various kinds of civil disturbance in Northern California. What he came up with was something called Garden Plot and Cable Splicer, two different, that was a code name of two different scenarios, okay, which were adopted for application in California under the Reagan administration, then ultimately peddled to the federal authorities. The FBI field tested both of them. That force structure integration was present on Pine Ridge during the operations on the Wounded Knee. They were field tested there, okay, then refined and perfected for a couple of years. Reagan got elected president. They set up FEMA. The founding director of FEMA was Louis Giafrida. That takes us to Rex 84. Rex 84 is basically a coordinated training exercise involving elite military units, SWAT teams from the state and local level in various capacities, National Guard units, FBI, the HRT, which they were talking about that time, the JTTF, intelligence structures, and they were involving certain segments of interesting little outfits like Wackenhut. I heard of Wackenhut? Yeah, private police and civic combines to reinforce the hull, responding to invasions of Sandinistas northward from Nicaragua at the time, as I recall.
And DOE facilities.
Yeah. So basically, step by step, I mean, these are the iterations. What you get in Praetor is the consummated official version of what it was that Giafrida conceived out here under those headings, Garden Plot and Cable Splicer, along about 1969. All right? Only it's no longer a scenario. They got various contingency plans, but they're not just scenarios. This is the actual formulation of the relations, and they have integrated response patterns and integrated force structures. And we're not talking about Mickey Mouse and some truck driver providing hot food in time of national emergency. You're talking about the most lethal element of the U.S. Ground Forces being redeployed in its mission, contrary to the Posse Comitatus Act, to be focused upon objectionable sectors of the U.S. population itself. And that's the reality of it. Tagline on that is, you don't need to worry about how to prevent this from becoming a police state.
It is.
Yeah, the question is what to do about it now that it is. So.